What's up, guys? I am Kelsey Wells. I'm your host. Welcome back to Redefine Fitness. Whew. I just want you to buckle up because today's episode is going to be, it can potentially be heavy. And I do want to say a little bit of a trigger warning. Well, I definitely want to say a trigger warning for disordered eating and eating disorders with this episode. If you have been with me from season one, and if you haven't, I really encourage you to go listen to those episodes prior to this one. But you will know that this is our safest space. This is where I can be my most vulnerable and speak freely and really talk deeply about so much of the issues that are still prevalent today and my personal experience and answer the questions that so many of you guys ask in confidence and in sincerity. And I don't think it's any surprise or secret that disordered eating is one of those in a very real way. I have with me today a guest who I am so honored to have on. She is a registered dietitian, a certified eating disorder specialist, and an approved supervisor, radically open dialectical behavior therapy scholar, and her name is Kayla Jessup. So she is local in Utah and which is where I am based, obviously. And she is the owner of a company called Kayla Jessup Nutrition Company, which is a group practice of RDNs working with folks with eating disorders or disordered eating. Kayla utilizes radically open dialectical behavioral therapy in practice through individual nutrition therapy and RODBT skills classes. So I can let her explain more of what that means and more of her history. She didn't start out here in Utah. And so welcome, a huge warm welcome to you, Kayla. Thank you so much for being on here today. I'm just, really honored.
Thank you for having me. I mean, this is such a nice opportunity because you do have such a big platform that this topic, eating disorders and disordered eating, unfortunately, doesn't get spoken about enough, in my opinion.
No.
So I think that this is beautiful that hopefully this can reach a lot of different families and friends to have more honest conversations with each other. But
That's the thing. Awareness is so key. And I understand it is hard to speak out on this, whether it's hard if it's personal for obvious reasons, but it's also hard as someone with a platform because you're afraid to do it wrong. You're afraid to have lashback or you're afraid to offend someone or trigger someone. But I can't let that stop me from bringing awareness to such a prevalent and important topic. So a little bit more before we kind of dive in, I'd love for you to kind of explain a little bit of your bio. So tell, kind of explain how you got to Utah, all of you, like a bit of your background.
Okay. All right. So I actually grew up like 30 minutes away from the border of Utah in Malad, Idaho, tiny town.
Yeah. Shout out.
And then did my schooling in Logan, Utah, moved to New York City with my husband. And that's where I did a lot of my eating disorder training. So I was the lead dietitian at a PHP, IOP, and outpatient level of care. Mm-hmm. So different levels to treat eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And then we started a family and I was like, I don't think I can raise children in New York City. I'm scared. So we came back to Utah and this is where I really officially opened up my group practice.
Which has turned into more than one.
Yeah. I mean, it was... I definitely had the intention of having a single solo practice, but I was shocked when I moved to Utah to see the severity of eating disorders in this state, and the numbers were overwhelming for me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, now we have a group practice because we honestly can't keep up with the demand, which is really sad. And our practice focuses on intuitive eating, legalizing food, you know, no bad foods or good foods, food is food. We believe in health at every size strongly.
Yes.
So we come from this philosophy and preach that to our clients and we see amazing progress with their recovery.
Absolutely. And those are all things that I absolutely believe in as well, from my personal and professional experience. And I think anyone who doesn't, it's so interesting to me because being in the health and fitness field and hearing other nutritionists or experts kind of go against those things, I feel like they are remiss in the sense that they lack the understanding of the danger of disordered eating and the fact that, I always say this, nothing you could have eaten is as unhealthy for you as shaming yourself or guilting yourself for eating, because the psychological toll that these things take is far unhealthier than eating something that is processed or has seed oil or whatever they're saying you can't do, right? So I am so on the same page with you. When I found your profile, I actually do want to talk about like how we kind of got connected. So I always share a lot of resources and assets around Eating Disorder Awareness Week, which it is. And this year I felt really strongly, I was finally not traveling, and I have some team members with me here who are based in Australia. And so I wanted to try to do something in person. So we decided to organize an in-person awareness event. And I knew that obviously I needed to partner with a mental health expert who focuses on disordered eating to really be the voice for that and carry the message and help me raise that awareness. And we went through Alliance for ED's Instagram page and then website, and they have a register of practitioners in every state. And we're looking at the many practitioners based in Utah, and you stood out to me for a number of reasons. And reaching out to you, and then we were able to meet and have a conversation. And I just felt like we were so aligned in our content and our messaging, and I just feel like the stars aligned. So I'm so grateful. And Kayla will be at the live event, which is sold out. But if you're local to Utah, I would encourage you to come. So we planned that event first. And then I realized, obviously, it's only a very small number who are going to be able to hear from you there. So I needed to have you on the podcast to kind of speak about similar things here, but also go a little bit deeper, because we have as much time as we need. And again, like I said, this is like my most sacred, safe little space with my Brandon to talk about these important but tender things, if you will. So, okay. So if you've listened, you know that I've opened up here on the podcast about my personal experience with disordered eating and eating disorders to an extent. And I've always said that I've never been diagnosed with an eating disorder. And I think simply because I never went to anyone to talk about that. When I was struggling at my worst, and I was aware that I was struggling, I also was still holding on to some very sad, toxic stigmas that if I went to seek help, I would be a failure, or that I should be strong enough to handle this alone. Or obviously the phases of denial where I felt like, it's fine, you know? So Kayla and I talked previous to starting this episode, but I kind of wanted to fill you guys in. I have written, no shock to anyone, a poem about my experience. I actually went to kind of sit down about 6 months ago and put pen to paper on my own personal history with these things, because it's so broad and scattered throughout different phases of my life. It's looked different throughout different phases of my life. And that came out in a poem form. I didn't want to share that just myself, because I felt like if I was going to share those actual symptoms and things that I have gone through, I needed to do so with a professional who could really help me talk through these things. And I also felt like if I could do this publicly, instead of just going to therapy and doing this, essentially having a live therapy session for all the world to hear, it would have very, very much helped me and reached me at various points in my journey to help me understand that certain behaviors are indeed not healthy, and also help me understand that, obviously bring that awareness, but also help me understand that there is nothing to be ashamed of. So this episode will be heavy, but I hope and I know that it will also be uplifting, because there is always help and healing. And so I'm going to read, this is the first time Kayla's heard my journey. So she's going to, I'm going to read this poem. It's long, it's not memorized, but I'm going to read it to her and obviously to all of you. And then we're going to talk through the pieces of this that she would consider either disordered eating, or that she might have said at that time, oh, that would be an eating disorder, what the difference is between those things, ways that I could or should have gotten help. And we're just going to have a very organic, genuine conversation with each other in hopes that it can help bring that awareness and help anyone who sees themselves at any point in my own journey. So, anything you want to add before I dive in, Kayla?
I just think it's really amazing that you're doing this. I think it's brave. I think it's vulnerable. And I think those are things that often stop people from calling people like me. Is even having a 10-minute call with me is sometimes so scary that they don't do the call, and then they put it off for another year or decade before they get help. So I think this could inspire a lot of people.
That's the hope. So, okay. Years old, junior year, homecoming night. I told you Kelsey was anorexic. I mean, plain white rice, and she only took 2 bites. Well, it's not even working. She still has cellulite on her thighs. The bathroom door swung shut. I sat in the stall and I cried. Then I got up and I dried my eyes. Time to rejoin those girls and my date. The only safe thing for me to eat with my allergy at the Asian restaurant was steamed white rice. I was not anorexic, but maybe I should give it a try. 18 years old, university, freshman year. Whoa, I thought, standing naked in the mirror, I can see my ribs. No wonder mom's scared. My first year of college, I lost meant my thighs and calves were about the same size around. My thigh gap could be measured in inches, the ultimate goal of 2007, fitness. Funny enough, you know what the truth is? That was maybe the only time in my early adulthood that my eating actually wasn't disordered. My body was overproducing the acid in my stomach. If I ate, any food made me immediately sick, but chronic pain ensued when I didn't. Turned out, it was raging anxiety that was eating me away. Constant panic plagued my mind as the sun set each day. These pills should fix it, I heard the doctor say. So we figured it out, got it under control, but the praise of my thinness had taken its toll. Not gaining too much weight back became my new subconscious goal. Flash forward, your typical 20-year-old girl, searching how to trialing every fad diet on earth. Disordered eating? That's absurd. My diet was eating junk food or eating clean, aka as little as possible, or the new cleanse from the magazine. In the cupboards, my roommates hung motivational quotes. A moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips. I'll put back that box of honey bunches of oats. Nothing tastes as good as being skinny feels. I'd starve then break, binging hidden midnight meals. Constant praise and envy of my thinness was both felt and said. I still need to be thinner, I thought in my head. Meanwhile, rumors spread. Meanwhile, I denied them. Always seemed to be eating, but starving myself instead. Then the guilt came, so I changed the game. This is not about food. Damn them for judging, and damn myself too. My old anxiety was back raging. My distorted body image was new. I fought demons that even... my closest people knew nothing of. So much of my world felt out of my control, but I'd be damned if my eating was. I will teach myself discipline and prove that I'm enough. If I cannot eat any sugar for a month, that means that I'm disciplined and worthy of love. So I cut out all carbs, even fruit, for 60 days to prove to myself and to God I'm okay. I gave up cold cereal, soda, then fries to show God my willpower and earn blessings on high. The goals were empowering, that is, until I failed, and I'd have to start over but be harder on myself. I learned hunger is vicious. Why am I so weak? Not physically, well, that too, but my willpower, I mean. The cycles continued, and little did I know, controlling my eating was putting food in control. Constant battles in my mind were taking their toll. Turns out, hating your body hurts deep in your soul. Flash forward. I'm married. Life was beautiful and good. He loved me and saw me and my body in ways I never could. I gained weight and feigned okay, yet I tore myself down in my head still each day. At 24, I gave birth to our sunshine, a lifeline, but a new battle had begun. Postpartum, my anxiety resurfaced and raged on, hiding my eating or lack thereof, hiding my panic attacks, I thought, out of love. Hiding my fighting, my crying, my pain, hiding and pretending I was happy and sane. Hiding the guilt, choking on the shame, new moms are not meant to feel this way. Then one day it hit me, so sad, so deep, so true. I deserved better, and my body, she did too. The knowing, foreign yet familiar, brave and new, began with seeing and accepting all I was putting myself through. Seeing and accepting my relationship with eating had been feeding a deep self-abuse. Awareness, that was the key. Awareness and acceptance is how I set myself free. And no, I did not change overnight. But that was the moment I decided to fight not to be thinner or to shrink myself more, but to fight for my life, to build a new door, to a place I recalled I had lived in before, where my mind and my body were no longer at war. I fought for myself and my healing every day. I fought to believe what my husband would say. I fought for our son, who I vowed would not see me, seeing myself, treating myself, beating myself up this way. Through exercising for the first time to help myself heal, through eating and enjoying every bite of each meal, through realizing not every thought that I think is the truth, through relearning to love me and shift my internal view. And far before my body composition shifted in the mirror, I began to feel better and see myself clearer. Moving my body from love and not fear, the epiphany of exercise for empowerment, it led to my career. And while I would love to tell you my disordered eating struggles end there, that isn't the truth. And that wouldn't be fair. Turns out comparison always leads to I'm not enough. And it's difficult having your body so publicly judged. Are you pregnant? Repeated in my DMs each day. No, but we're trying, I wanted to say. By 2019, I had come so far, but began holding myself to an impossible bar. While I never returned to starving myself, I began macro counting in the name of my health. It was helpful and empowering even at first. Then somehow it shifted to being tied to my worth. Extreme obsession in the name of discipline. I'd restrict. Then I'd binge. Each time, promising this will never happen again. Each time, my budding confidence began waning thin. Sometimes I wish healing was linear, but it's not. Yet each time I struggled, I rose stronger because I fought. Fought again, fought to stay in that positive place. Fought to feel, fought to heal, fought to rest from the race. Fought to find peace of mind, fought to take up space, fought to balance the grind, fought to give myself grace, sought out help, sought out tools, sought to dismantle old rules, and those small daily efforts, they are everything. That's enough. My life, it is precious, and turns out it's predicated on the small, simple stuff, on allowing it all, on resting when I fall, then standing back up. Thoughts arise and feelings flow. Both these come and then they'll go. Underneath it all, it is crucial, I know. I am neither. And I am not my body either. I have a heart. And I am a soul. At 34, I feel I am finally free. I'm sitting in a cafe drinking coffee with cream. I no longer care if my cellulite is seen. There's a feeling of acceptance and returning to me. The days that I struggle are the exception, not the rule. I eat when I'm hungry and mostly stop when I'm full. In the moments an old trigger sounds in my mind, I pause and remind myself to be kind. I think of the wealth of the lessons that I've learned, of the sacred friendship with my body that I've earned. My body is not to be fought, but fought for. My body is a miracle, but still I am more. Nothing that I could put in my mouth is as unhealthy for me as allowing food choices to harbor guilt and self-doubt. Comparison is poison, and shame has no place. Confidence is not found in changing of my shape, but in living my truth and cutting through the tape of self-limiting beliefs that I let get in the way. I am growing and living and taking up space. I forgive myself when I make a mistake, and when my life feels out of control, I now know that's okay. I will continue to fight for myself every day. Now I stand tall, outside of my cage, the cage of self-loathing I forged without even knowing. And after hundreds and hundreds of days, that fight feels like flowing and roses bloom in my wake. Because I know, in my body, in my mind, in food freedom, I am safe.
Wow. That was so beautiful. I was teary throughout the whole thing. Thank you for sharing that. That was so poetic. And I feel like that touches on so many of my clients' experiences in so many different ways. So I'm grateful that you shared that, because I think that will definitely help a lot of people.
Of course. Thank you.
Yeah. So now, do you want some of my thoughts as like, as a dietitian type of thing?
I would love that. And I think, the poem gives such a brief tip of the iceberg,
right?
Mostly filtered view. But I think it's so important to kind of go through the fact that my struggles with eating, they transformed throughout different phases of my life. And sometimes, at least for me, I think when it was the unhealthiest and when I was really doing very unhealthy things to my body and truly starving myself or really binging, it actually wasn't about food at all. And I now know that that's normal, but because I think in my head, it had shifted from, you know, early college, the need and the want to be thin and to be praised for my thinness, because it had become about control, and I called it discipline, and proving myself to the higher power that I believed in at the time, who I now believe my higher power would never want me to do that, right? But back then, it's like I thought because it wasn't stemming about how my body looked, it couldn't have been an eating disorder or disordered eating. It was about controlling the things that I could control in life, which in a time where I felt very unsure and scared about a lot of other things. I felt a very severe loneliness at that point in my life. My husband was serving a mission for our church at that time, and I couldn't speak to him. And I wrote him letters, but obviously not about any of that stuff. And I have some other mental health things and like religious OCD and things that contributed to getting to that really severe point. But I would love for you to kind of describe how an eating disorder stems from many different things, and just the juxtaposition of there were times where it was very much about how I looked and like intentionally starving myself. But then there were, I feel like, maybe worse times where I didn't think it was about that at all, but it was still, you know, coming out through food.
Which ultimately leads to similar outcomes, whether it's appearance-based or control-based. The outcome is very similar, but people engage in disordered eating or eating disorder symptoms for a wide range of reasons. But I think what you're hitting on is what a lot of people sense is when your life feels so out of control and school's not going well or work's not going well, or you're going through a breakup, or when life isn't stable, then sometimes it's easy, air quotes, to focus on something that you can control, which is food. Food is a part of our everyday life. Typically, 6 times a day or more. Hopefully. Sometimes we're encountering food. And so if your anxiety is really high because X, Y, and Z isn't going well in your life, by controlling the food, whether that's restricting it or using other eating disorder behaviors, it can almost like have that relief of like, okay, well, something in my life is going better. I'm controlling something. And then it can definitely get into a habitual cycle, which could then lead to some pretty negative outcomes, both mentally as well as physically. Yeah. I think something else that you hit on in your poem that really stood out to me was the praise of thinness. I think we live in a society that greatly values appearance. And we've seen, you know, swings in how it's marketed. Maybe before it was thinness and now it's fitness and being, you know, in shape, in, you know, having a certain toned look. it went from, you know, do a diet to let's focus on wellness. It's all the same thing if you're obsessed about it.
Which I've learned very much, you know, on both ends of that with the 2000s diet culture, and which I spent a lot of time trying to dismantle. That's where my brand Redefined Fitness comes from. And yeah, I just feel like the rhetorics that sold fitness for decades and even still today are wrong. And it's about helping women understand that. I think exactly like you said, when I really go back to like, when did it start for me and why, it was truly, I didn't care about seeing cellulite on my thighs until I overheard some girls making fun of mine. And right, then of course I'm hyper fixated on that. And, yeah, you know, it was like, that was the first time where I thought, wow, I should starve myself because, you know, and, I mean, I never spoke about that experience to anyone, not my mom, not my sisters, who I was very close to. It just, it hurt me so much.
Yeah.
And I do know that if I had, they would have helped me. Because, yeah, but, and then still, it's like, I loved food so much, and I was genuinely pretty happy in high school. And it wasn't until like my first year of college when my anxiety disorder really made me lose. And I was diagnosed with an anxiety disorder my freshman year. I lost a lot of weight very quickly. And then it was just from there, it was like this spiral, I think. I was prescribed medication, which I took for about 6 months. And then I started to gain weight back. And I stopped taking it. Ryan didn't know. My parents didn't know. But I was, the fear of gaining weight back became, like, it's so sad for me to think now, but like that me then, I was more scared of gaining any weight back than I was about literally living so sickly and like the damage that was actually being done to my physical body, which is so sad looking back.
It's sad, but it also makes sense to an extent, right? Because you were essentially bullied for cellulite or for how your body looked at some point in your life, right? And that can last a lifetime, right? Those words and those comments that people make, whether, and I think that's something that I want like our audience to know, is whether you are making a comment about somebody's body in a negative way, talking about cellulite in a mean, cruel way, or you are praising somebody's thigh gap, both comments can absolutely create a lifelong decades of disordered eating or eating disorders. So kind of like just being mindful of our words.
It's really validating to hear. I mean, when I moved in with to an apartment my sophomore year of college with music, dance, theater majors, and these women were incredible and lovely, and I'm still close with some of them to this day, and I just love them so dearly. But it was definitely very much ingrained in, they were more victims than anyone else with all of the bullshit, because obviously their world was dancing and their bodies were scrutinized all the time. But
yeah,
them and their world praising, like, oh, if only I was as thin as you, or like, oh my God, you look like they were on the craziest diets. And it was so bizarre. It was like, you're exactly right. You know, just being, and the other thing is that was the first time in my life that I don't know, like, I'd love for you to tell me if this is body dysmorphia, but I couldn't see how thin I was. I was still in the mindset of 17, 16 years old that I just needed to lose. And it was that moment, I remember there were a couple moments. The first one was like, people would start praising my thinness a lot after my freshman year of college, but I didn't see myself or consider myself as very thin. And I mean, everyone was worried about me. My mom took me to the doctor and my doctor kicked my mom out of the room and was like, you need to be honest with me. Like, are you? And I was like, no, like they thought I had we rolled out all kinds of things, a worm, like gluten, you know, maybe I was celiac, maybe all of these different things to make me have the severe weight loss. Yeah. I was very sickly looking. I mean, I weighed pounds, maybe less. I could see all my ribs when I looked in the mirror. I mean, we were walking to a football game one night and I said something. I was walking with Ryan and I said, I pointed at this girl in front of us and I was like, oh, she's so tiny. Like, she's so tiny. And he literally stopped in me in our tracks and he was like, Kelsey, he's like, I mean, I do have to say, like, he was the biggest advocate for me through all of this. And he said, why? He said, you compare yourself a lot to people and it hurts me. It hurts my feelings when you do that because I love you. And he's like, and also your legs are thinner than hers. And the fact that you don't know that, do you really not know that? And yeah. it kind of shook me a lot. And I think I made a joke or brushed it off. And it was like later that night where I was standing there and I was like, wow, like I actually maybe am very sickly looking, like scary looking thin, but I just didn't see myself like that. And I don't, it sounds crazy, but I genuinely didn't.
Right. And it's great that you had a friend, you had a partner, a husband that can point it out to you and that you could hear that feedback and take it in a little bit. Because part of the sickness is being in denial. I believe that's actually a part of the diagnosis of having an eating disorder is like this thought of, I'm not that bad. It's not that big of a problem. Or I don't look that sick.
Yeah, always I thought that.
Yeah. And so that's super common. It's also very common to compare when you're in it or when you're not in it in our society. But comparison of body sizes, of pant sizes, of did I eat more than her? Did he eat less than me? There's this constant game of comparison. So even our audience who's listening, like check in with yourself too. Like, have you noticed comparing your air quote numbers of what you weigh to Kelsey's? You know, sometimes that can be a really challenging thing for a lot of people. Do I think it's body dysmorphia? Sounds like it, but I would probably need more information. But, you know, part of it is that when there's not enough food coming in, for whatever the reason, right? Because you have cancer or because you have an eating disorder or disordered eating, the brain gets malnourished. And it's very hard to see a lot of the world in the state that it is, including what you look like in the mirror. And so as, you know, a big part of recovery for a lot of people is to gain weight, which is one of the most fearful things, like you mentioned, to do for them. And that's really what helps the brain get re-nourished so that you can see yourself in a way that everyone else sees you. Obviously, your husband, you know, loves you. And so he was trying to show you that then. I imagine he shows you that now, right? So it's like, it's scary to weight rehabilitate. I hear it, I feel it, I do it every day with my clients to try to encourage them and know that your body image or how you see your body most of the time gets a lot better as you gain weight or when you're done gaining weight, which seems mind-blowing for
because
people.
You're actually malnourished, like your chemical brain is being affected.
Right. Now your brain is online. It's working for you instead of against you. And so now you can practice, like you mentioned, skills that you used towards the end of your recovery journey. And I'm aware of imagining that was probably easier for you to do because you were more nourished towards the end, accessing skills and being able to respond flexibly to to different situations is incredibly difficult to do when you are not eating enough.
That's, I mean, exceptionally validating for sure. And looking back, I've always said, like, as I gained more weight and I didn't know that piece, and hearing that, like, it just validates so deeply all of, you know, my personal healing journey. And I feel like it's been different at different times. I feel like, I mean, you're right. I will be honest, like, back then, I would probably say it was after Ryan left and I was like alone all the time, every day, all day long. Cause I didn't live at home with my parents. I was, you know, on my own at college, but I had no, my best friend at the time, she lived hours away from me. And like, there was truly no one. Like, I used to think about the fact that, like, I would go hiking by myself, and I used to think about the fact often that, like, if I disappeared, I don't think anyone would even think to look for me for 4 or 5 days. I don't think any soul in this world would notice that I was gone, because I didn't have anyone that spoke to me every day, and the person I had was a world away, you know. And I had people in my life that loved me, but it's like I isolated myself just as much, you know. It was just right. and hearing that it's about, like, it's something that even now feels shameful to admit, the amount of mental space that these things took up in my head. Every time I walked into a room, I would like see if there was anyone smaller than me every time. And that's something I've never said out loud. Yeah. I would, whenever I would like feel hunger pains, I taught myself that that was a sign to, that of my strength, if I could just bear through that. And then I learned that they would pass for another hour or so, that I could just get through that. And, then I was stronger. But thinking about eating or not eating, or how many hunger pains I could go through until I gave in and ate something, like, this was hours of my mental space every day.
Yeah.
Then flash forward to, more recently, you know, right pre-pandemic, like 2019, when, again, I didn't think at the time anything was wrong or that I was struggling. Looking back, that's the second time in my life where, like, truly, I mean, I was macro counting and I thought, of course, I don't have an eating disorder. I'm not experiencing anything unhealthy or disordered eating because I'm eating. I'm not starving myself. I'm not doing that to my body. But it was the intense obsession. Like, right. I had to hit my macros to the gram every day. And then when I was prepping for like a shoot or filming for my career, I would go even harder and I would say, okay, I'm going to hit my macros, but also I'm going to go in a slight deficit, which, if I'm being 100% honest, for the amount of activity I do, and even though I'm like, I'm not starving, I'm eating 1500 calories a day. Well, when you're burning that many calories a day and your total daily energy expenditure is that high, that actually was probably starving myself. Yeah. But it was the amount of hours every day that I would obsess over what I was going to eat next, measuring out every increment of everything I put in my mouth. If I took a bite of Anderson's snack, like, that was going in my Fitness Pal. And it was like, before a shoot, it was like, not only did I have to hit my macros, but I had to hit them by only eating like green juice and protein shakes.
Yeah.
And almonds. And it was just so, it became so obsessive. But I also thought, okay, this is my career. My body's being scrutinized by the whole world. I'm going to, like, I know that the women that I train, I would never, like, if somebody that I love told me that they were doing this, of course that wouldn't be healthy, but they're not a fitness professional and they're not held to the standard. And I'm aware and I'm fine and I'm fine and I'm fine. But, um, I don't know, it doesn't feel fine. And then the problem was the more obsessive I got and the more disciplined I was, I eventually broke and I started to binge. And yeah. I didn't think that it was binging because I wouldn't purge. But I mean, there were times I wasn't eating till I was like a little bit too full. It was like if I ate something that I wasn't supposed to, or if I blew my macros, then I would eat myself sick.
Right.
And I would eat anything and everything I could possibly think I'd ever crave the rest of my life, because by Monday I was never, ever going to eat it ever again. And it was this very like finite mindset, and I wasn't enjoying anything I was eating, and I was doing it. Like I would hide it.
Yeah.
Hide it from Ryan. And I just hated myself as I was doing it. But I just thought, oh, well, if I'm not throwing up, then I'm fine.
Yeah.
Because I was taught that, you know, there was anorexia and there's bulimia. So, like, I'm good.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the case.
No, right. Because it still weighs on you so heavily. And I hope that's when people are listening to this, also considering like how much time do you personally, whoever's listening, spend thinking about food, exercise, your body, because you mentioned the hours, right, of your day that would be spent regardless of the symptoms. It's super normal for people struggling with disordered eating or eating disorders to go from restriction to binging, to purging, to overexercising, to laxative abuse, et cetera.
I did that as well.
Yeah. And so I, sometimes people get confused because they're like, wait, you know, I thought I was just a restrictor, which unfortunately our society puts on a pretty high pedestal. Versus binging, people do feel typically a lot more shame around. But the way I like to see it is your body was keeping you alive when you probably weren't keeping her alive, type of thing. Your body was like, okay, if Kelsey can't get in enough, we're going to take care of her and we're going to make sure we get in enough to keep her functioning, to keep her moving, to keep her organs running. So it really is a safety mechanism that our bodies go through when there's restriction involved. And when I say restriction, you even mentioned, you know, when you counted macros, there was probably some points in your macro counting where you were eating enough, technically speaking, right? But there's a big difference between physical restriction and cognitive restriction, meaning I would like some ice cream after this call. And if I cognitively tell myself I can't eat it, I shouldn't eat it, that is restricting yourself. And that can definitely lead to binges too. So, you know, I think I try to help folks see when they feel the shame around the eating habits and the hours they've spent in their lives, trying to remind yourself that you learned this from somewhere. And you probably learned this at a very young age, especially if you grew up in the US. I mean, I think the statistics right now are 80% of 10-year-olds are scared of getting fat. So instead of being like, oh gosh, I suck, you know, what's wrong with me? Thinking like, wow, the culture we live in is pretty darn toxic when it comes to body sizes and food, and trying to maybe put the emotion of maybe anger towards that messaging that we've all received that really does mess with our mental abilities to feed ourselves.
Yeah. And I have become aware of that at different points in my journey. Like I do know that I'm a victim of all the TV show, just going back to what normal, the things that were included. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think all of us were a victim of that diet culture conditioning that was so subliminal on so many levels. And then also just right in your face on so many levels.
Right.
But again, it was kind of like, if it wasn't these black and white, like two eating disorder, very, very extreme things, then I was fine. Mm-hmm. And based upon like those, my own things that I just described to you, like if I had come to you during that time in 2019 as your client and said all of that, like what do you think that I would have definitely had disordered eating or an eating disorder? Or would it have been like, because I genuinely thought it was fine when right. I was in it, you know?
And most people do think it's totally fine. Also because most people get validation that their behaviors are actually a good thing. Not even from family and friends, from doctors that, you know, we all look up to. They have so much education. And a doctor just told my client yesterday that she's totally fine when she is anything but fine right now. So to go back to your question, what would I think? I would think you would have disordered eating, and their line between disordered eating and an eating disorder is so bloody thin, because the only difference really is the severity. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, how many times are you binging a week type of thing? Mm-hmm. And if you meet a certain level, then it becomes a diagnosed eating disorder, because the symptoms are the same. And I really want to encourage folks to get help, whether they have an eating disorder or disordered eating, because suffering is suffering. And you know what? When I get folks who have disordered eating come to my practice, they get better much quicker than folks with full eating disorders. And they can get back to their life quicker. So just a strong encouragement to not wait until that fine line is crossed. Get help now.
Thank you so much. I think that was exactly what was hoping you'd say, in the sense of like, I know that it was such a steady line. And I think if I was really honest with myself, I did realize when it was starting to tip, but I just justified given absolutely, like the more shredded I was, the more trusted, the more people would trust me as their trainer, the more people would train with me, the more people, and the message I was putting out there was so healthy and good. And this is something that's like, I've opened up about the first half of that, but the pieces about, you know, 2018, 2019, like it hurts my soul that like I was online advocating for these same things and I was still struggling so much. And I feel so hypocritical. But I just made myself the exception in my head, you know? My intention was never to be dishonest with anyone. And I believed so much in my heart with all the things I said. And then I realized that I was starting to become a lot harder on myself. And it was the confidence that I had gained in my healing the first time, you know, in early marriage and early motherhood, it was slipping. And I was starting to be very compare myself again. I was starting to pick my body apart again. I was starting to become super obsessed with comparison, with food, with all the things again. And I just didn't realize like that it could look two totally different ways, but be really the same thing.
Right.
And so like you said, like I feel like if I would have just had the courage or been told point blank, like there is no shame in talking to someone at any point, then maybe I wouldn't have gone so far.
Right.
So I just want to echo what you just said to anyone listening. Like, if you've experienced any bit of these things that we're talking about, it's like you should not and do not need to wait until you feel like you are struggling enough or severe enough to go get help, because the sooner you do, the easier healing can be for you and the faster that can look for you. And I feel that now, because today when I do feel old triggers creeping up, I'm very much on top of it. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I am very proud of. I think honestly breaking my ankle 2 years ago and spending essentially, I was on bed rest those first 2 weeks and then in a hard cast, like immobile, the first, mm-hmm. the 6 weeks after that, I felt a lot of those triggers of like, oh my God, I'm not exercising, so I better just not eat. And I made the cognizant choice, like, no, I will nourish my body. And every, like, I have, you know, stopped counting macros completely for a long time. And then I would only count protein. And if I felt during that time when I was on the couch, I actually started counting again to make sure that I was eating 1800 calories, even though I was doing zero movement, because I knew that innately I would not eat enough and I wanted to be eating nutrients. And so it's like now not waiting, like I will never again wait. And I will never again allow shaming myself to prevent me from helping myself, essentially. So, yeah.
Right. Because early intervention is one of the biggest helpers to get you to full recovery. If you can intervene early in your life and get help as quick as possible, that's what's going to probably save you years, you know, months, years, decades of your life. Experience living in New York City for a period of time, people are very pro mental health. Mm. People got help early if there was a problem, for the most part. And the severity of cases that I saw there was a lot less than I see in Utah, which Utah has more of a stigma around mental health. And so people, unfortunately, here wait longer to get help. And then by the time they talk to somebody like me, oftentimes they have to go to higher levels of care or get really intense treatment when they could have reached out maybe a year earlier or 5 years earlier.
Yeah, wow. I think this is the perfect time to bring up something that I feel so strongly about, but I really want to hear your thoughts on. Anytime that I speak out about something like this, I get so much hate and lashback online, in the sense of like, I don't look, how dare I speak on this when I look like I do? Because mm-hmm. I don't know how it feels to really struggle or whatnot. That's essentially the thing. And it's difficult because you can say, I have a tough skin, but at a certain point, like, it's right. still very mentally hard to get so much hate from a lot of strangers. But my point wow. that I always try to say is like, listen, and the reason that I still, not as often as I probably should, but as often as I have courage, still talk about things like cellulite, for example, it's like, I am aware of how I look and how people see my body. However, to me, it is so, it is never okay to tell someone that they can't or shouldn't struggle or that their struggles are invalid. If right. someone says this is a problem for me, that's that. Because right. from something like cellulite, like I never had extreme cellulite, but it was so extreme in my head. The amount of time and space it took up in my head, I tied my worth to that, my right. worthiness to that. It was a huge problem for me, not because of how it physically was, because of right. what I made it out to be.
Right.
And it's the same thing with the point is, especially with things like disordered eating and eating disorders, you cannot ever tell by looking at someone how deeply or if they struggle. And it is so dangerous to be dismissive. Oh, you're in a body that looks like that, so of course you aren't starving yourself, or of course you're not struggling, or oh, you, it's like people won't accept it as valid until you are such an extreme. And even such extremes can be so hidden. And so right. just the fact that eating disorders do indeed, the data, I'd love for you to share the data on, like, it affects men, it affects women, mm-hmm. it affects all ages, it affects all body sizes and shapes. And you can never tell by looking at someone that if they're struggling and how much they're struggling.
Which is why I think it's good that you're talking about this, because this is a great example that Hollywood, unfortunately, has given this image of what an eating disorder looks like. But in reality, I have a group practice. We treat a lot of individuals with eating disorders and disordered eating. and the vast majority of our clientele are straight-sized bodies or they live in larger-sized bodies. And statistically speaking, I believe it's 7% of people with an eating disorder would be diagnosed as underweight. Wow. If you're thinking about the BMI.
Wow.
So it's not the norm to be struggling with an eating disorder and be underweight. The norm is to have a straight sized body or a larger sized body. If you're fat, and I mean fat in a positive way, if you have a fat body, you are more likely to have an eating disorder.
Wow.
So I hope people can hear that it doesn't discriminate. We had a five-year-old come to us last year. So it can affect anyone at any point in their life. And going back to people giving you comments, let's stop talking about people's bodies. It's not about the body. It's about how you perceive your body. That is the definition of body image. Yes. It's not what you look like. It's what you think you look like.
That's so perfectly put. Man. Yeah. I mean, thank you. I can't stress that enough. I think it's so important for people to understand. I would love you to share. I looked up, and I did read from some reputable sources on my last season when I spoke about, I wanted to do an episode about food and my food philosophy, but I couldn't speak to that before I spoke about this part of it. And I didn't share in my personal stuff at that time, but I would love for you to share the up to date, even from last year, statistics of, are eating disorders going away? Are they worse than ever? What does it look like right now? Like from a scientific, just data point of view, how bad is it? Who's it affecting? Like the statistics.
It's worse than ever, which to me makes a lot of sense because social media, it just continues to get bigger and bigger. We already talked about how competitive disordered eating and eating disorders are. So unfortunately, I don't see in the coming years it getting a lot better. 9% of the U.S. Have diagnosed eating disorders. That equates to about almost 30 million people. And of that 30 million, I believe it's 70% won't reach out for help.
Wow.
Which is really devastating. And it goes back to what we talked about with mental health stigma, misconceptions of, do I have an eating disorder or do I not? Like, look at my body type of thoughts. Misdiagnosis is a large part of it, a large part of the problem. People in larger bodies perhaps go into a medical weight loss facility and not getting diagnosed. Mm. There's a lot of problems, but it's continuing to increase. I mean, I think during the pandemic, hotlines like Nita's hotline increased over 100% of calls coming in. Cause it's just, we kind of talked about how eating disorders are isolating. You're hiding. It's secretive. And then put COVID on top of that. Yeah. It's a mess.
Yeah. And to those who would say that this is silly or like there's bigger problems or like so many people minimize this, especially when it's not super severe. But the statistic that shook me and really made me decide to speak out a lot more vocally on my platforms about this and was that I read, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that eating disorders have the highest mortality rate after opiate abuse for all mental correct. Health. Is that true?
That is true. Yeah. And it's so deadly. And I've seen it in both ways, unfortunately, where this isn't just a mental illness that leads people to commit suicide. It's also physiological and leads people to have a heart attack or die from medical complications. And so it's incredibly deadly, which is why A lot of therapists don't work with people who have eating disorders because it's high risk. It's considered a high risk mental illness.
But they need the most help. You know, it seems cruel.
Yeah. Unfortunately, eating disorders kind of fall into this crack of, oh, I'm too mentally ill for doctors to really understand, but I'm also too medically complicated for therapists to take on. And so it's just, it's not good.
Yeah. It's very sobering. It's very sad. It makes me so grateful for people like you who are doing real work to provide real help for these millions of people that need it. I, of course, like I said in my poem and whenever I speak about this, the most important message I want to communicate is that it's never too late. Do you believe that?
It's never too late. Never too late. I'm thinking of so many clients right now who thought their life was basically over. Kayla, I've been doing this since I was 10 years old. They're 40s. They're in their 50s. They're in their 60s. They can turn it around. So can other people.
But I love that. And before I ask you on like tangible tips and steps to start seeking help, I want to ask you something. I'm a mom to a boy. I know that eating disorders don't discriminate with girls and boys. He's almost 10. And I'm also an aunt to beautiful nieces. I want to know for myself as a parent and as an aunt, but also to anyone listening who has young children, young girls that they're raising, what signs do you look for? Because unfortunately, as you said, the statistics are showing that it's affecting 10-year-old kids. I mean, it's younger and younger. So what signs do you look for in the young children? And also when you do have a young girl making comments on her body or wanting to not eating, what do you do particularly for that next generation? Like as someone who is part of raising that next generation, what do you look for? And then how do you help them at that age to redirect so that they don't get the same rhetorics that we were, you know?
Right. I think the best way is to model. I try and encourage parents to model for their children what they hope to instill in them. So meaning like trying to be mindful of how you talk about food in front of your children. Are you using words like this is bad and this is good and this is healthy and this is unhealthy and you can't have the Oreo until you eat X, Y, and Z? Because those are putting concepts in children's brains of what is good and what is bad and setting rules around food. So I think a lot of times my advice to parents is just checking in with yourself and seeing what types of messages do you maybe say that you have no intentions of harming or, you know, sure, giving bad messages to your kids, but your kids are listening and they're watching you too. So being mindful of your words, being mindful of how you talk about other people's bodies, like we mentioned earlier. Those, I would say, are the biggest things. Model what it's like to eat normally with your kids, eat with your children as much as you can, so that they can see what is a normal, what a normal breakfast is. And we can talk about these options of ways to get help too. But I think modeling is my number one advice.
So if you are doing your best to model, and man, like I gotta say, just hearing that, it's interesting because I'm really trying to think about how I parent. I'm obviously very conscious of this, and with Anderson, I mean, I definitely have tried to teach him that it is wonderful and great. Like it's about nourishing your body, right? So it's about eating nutrients, and we always have treats and we have them together as a family. And that's a fun and good thing. But then I also feel like, but he has to get his nutrients, like he needs to eat. But I've said things like, okay, yeah, if you eat your nutrients first and then you can have a fun treat. So then like but is that wrong to say, like, that he needs to eat, you know, his chicken and rice and whatever we're having for dinner, and then he can have the chocolate muffin? You know, is that problematic?
I think it depends on the family. I don't think, you know, one size fits all. Mm-hmm. It depends on the child and the situation. For the most part, I like to steer families in the direction of, let's put all the food out on the table at once, including dessert, mm-hmm. and let the child pick what they're going to be eating, and the parents zip it when it comes to what the client, or what the client, what the child is picking. Because with time, children like to be like mommy and daddy, or, you know, mommy and mommy. And so they will start to see, oh, interesting, mommy puts chicken on her pasta too. Maybe I'll try it tonight, even though maybe the child hasn't tried it for the past 3 nights. But they will learn. So because once we start giving little comments around, like, let's not eat the muffin until later, or let's not have the dessert until after, or we have to eat this first, mm-hmm. it still is smuggling in this concept of good and bad type of thing.
Yeah.
Even though it might not be our intentions. Yeah. And then what happens is kids sometimes are like, ooh, maybe I just want the muffins, and maybe I'm going to wait until mommy and daddy are leave, and I'm going to go 10 muffins and hide them in my bedroom.
Yes. And that's something. Yeah. I mean, it's so hard, right? Because you want your kids to have the nutrients and everything. And if your kid's a picky eater, then that's tough. But I think that's, for any parents listening, again, I think it really does come down to understanding, because yes, it's of course important to try to feed your body, or your body and your kid's body's nutrient dense, like, foods of all kinds. But it is, because of the prevalence of these things that we've been speaking about, their mental health has to come first. And I always say, we can no longer afford to let our efforts in exercise or nutrition be a detriment to our mental health. Yeah. And what I'm hearing from you is that in parenting, even though you might say, okay, it's not good for my kid to eat a chocolate bar first thing in the morning, if they're exhibiting signs, especially of these early disordered eating thoughts or patterns, or you know, negativity around their bodies, then it's actually unhealthier for them to learn that that's a bad food, or that they can't have that until. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Yeah. And parents, just so y'all know, I'm a parent of a 4-year-old. So I also, the dialectic of this is, you can set boundaries with your child. My daughter asked me this morning for ice cream for breakfast. And I said, what did I say? I said, ice cream is not on the menu for breakfast today, and we can have some later tonight, probably. Yeah. So it's like, you can hold the boundary of what's on the menu, because you, the parent, are in charge of what's being served.
Yes.
The child is in charge of whether picking they eat it or not.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. I love that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask one more question, like one step further. So you said, obviously, it's situational, which it absolutely is. So what if in the situation of having a young kid, who you do hear, you know, say she's 9 years old, and she comes home from school and says, I'm fat, I'm ugly, I'm this, and she's using these things in a negative way about herself. What do you do then? What should be a next step?
I would probably explore it with her of, like, tell me where this is coming from. Did something happen at school? Because I'm kind of curious if there was comments made or bullying, like we talked about. And then I would, you know, ask her how that makes her feel. Because I think a lot of times parents jump to fixing, like, how can I fix this? How can I, like, educate my child that, like, being fat isn't a bad thing? Mm-hmm. But sometimes we just need to sit with the 8-year-old and have them express that maybe they did get bullied that day about their body, and they are sad, and they just need a hug from mom, and to be told that things are going to be okay. And then you can save your educational speech for later, because right then maybe they just need to cry, and that's okay.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you. Man, I feel like there's so much that we've covered. I do really want to give you the floor to just speak about you know, obviously we've already spoken about like when to get help. It's whenever you feel like you're struggling with any or all or some of these things that we've spoken about, to any degree is a great time. As soon as you notice is a great time, the sooner the better. And there's obviously, I hope that people have gotten the message that there's absolutely no stigma or shame in seeking help. So what would you say to someone who is now hearing this and maybe feeling like, wow, I'm going to reach out. Where do they start? Like, how can they help themselves or seek out help?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different local programs that I imagine would be nearby. Mm-hmm. So you can even Google search like eating disorder recovery near me. And I'm sure there will be pop-ups. Even if you think I don't have an eating disorder, but you are identifying with this topic and you feel like you might have some disordered eating, though it might, you'll probably get in providers' hands who also follow a nutritional philosophy or health philosophy as me. So you can always do local. You can go to NEDA's website, NEDA, National Eating Disorder Association's website. They have different hotlines if you just want to talk to someone and they can give you resources. I think you shared another one. The National Alliance for Eating Disorders is another great like nationwide place that people can get help. My practice, KaylaJessupNutrition.com, we can accept folks from out of state in a lot of different states as well as Utah. So we can certainly provide services as well.
Thank you so much. And obviously it's ideal for someone to go and get help in those ways that you just spoke. I think it's important to highlight that even if you, for some reason, can't, whether it be financially or whether it be maybe you're young and your parents, you're afraid to tell your parents or something like that, online resources, like you mentioned, the NEDA hotlines, and there are ways that you can help yourself, even if you don't. I hope that everyone listening has a support or has parents who might, but unfortunately, sometimes parents are causing these kinds of things, or you just, it is such a lonely thing. And maybe you're in a position where you don't want anyone to know that knows you. Mm-hmm. You can still find ways to start healing. And one of those is definitely the hotlines. What else would you say for that kind of situation?
Emily program, I believe, is a reduced rate or maybe even free. Let's say somebody calls the NEDA, National Eating Disorder Association. If you were to call or text them, they could also give you, and you have like no funds for treatment, they can also direct you to other places beyond Emily program that can give you ways to help yourself if funds are a concern.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And,
well, I feel so grateful for your openness and willingness to chat through this. And I feel very validated for my personal journey and also very hopeful that, as I mentioned in the beginning, anyone that can see themselves or their own struggles in any piece of what we've spoken about just knows that, first of all, they're not alone, that it's never too late, and that even though this is a more prevalent of a problem than ever, there are a lot of resources, and having that awareness is the first step. And so to do that, you know, they can, I always feel like it's so hard, like especially wanting to make these changes in my industry and with to help as many people make these changes as possible, it feels like an uphill battle. And to know that it's just getting worse, not better, I'm like, what is it like? How, like it's so hard. But then I just remember, like, I changed my life. Mm-hmm. And that's everything for me. And that hopefully will mean so much to my son and the people in my life. And you might not have the control to change this on a large scale. You and I don't, but we can do our best. And that for us is personally and professionally, but for anyone listening, it might seem daunting and scary, and it is, and it's serious, and it is, but you do have power to make change for you. And you have no clue, and that's everything for you. And then you don't know the ripple effect that you will have on those that you love and the younger generations that you're that are in your life. And when enough of us make change on a personal level for ourselves, that is the only way that this will ever change on a cultural level. And so it matters. It matters so much.
It matters so much. If one person makes a change, think of the generations that are going to come from that one person that won't have to struggle with hating their body every day. It is a ripple effect, and I see people recover all the time. It's definitely possible. So I hope people will reach out and get some support if they need it.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Kayla. And thank you everyone for listening. We are sending you so much love.
Thank you for having me.